Nicholas Blomley, Shut the Province Down, First Nations Blockades in British Columbia, 1984-1995. BC Studies, number 111, Autumn, 1996. Quote, "We stand in the position of sovereignty against International Forest Products, Interfor, and the British Columbia and Canadian governments' unlawful trespassing and destruction of Nooksalk territory. As the Nooksalk Nation, we have the sovereign right to jurisdictional rule within our territory. This right comes from Tatau, the Creator. It is not granted nor subject to the approval of any other nation. Our land has never been seceded, sold, or treated. We cannot and never will, as the Nooksalk Nation, compromise this position. It is our obligation to Tatau, the Creator, to care for and protect our lands." End quote. First Nations blockades have become so commonplace in British Columbia over the last two decades that they have, ironically, slipped from view. Every summer, it seems, brings another round of roadblocks, closely followed by the predictable round of condemnation and fulmination on editorial pages and in the provincial legislature. Even when relative peace reigns on the logging roads and access routes of the province, the threat of blockades is ever present. Perhaps it is this very frequency and predictability that explains why blockades have not received much scholarly attention as a political phenomenon. As a consequence, our understanding of blockades is largely framed by the media, which tend to treat each blockade as a singular and often sensational event, paying little attention to the context within which it is deployed or to its relation to similar tactics. This is unfortunate. Not only does it distance us from the underlying problems that engender blockades, but it also makes it easy to dismiss them as aberrant and those behind them as illegitimate. In this article, I offer an introductory overview of blockades in British Columbia over the last 15 years. I first document and describe blockades, then point to some of the underlying grievances that prompt them, before considering why the blockade, as opposed to other forms of protest or direct action, is such a powerful tool. I close with a brief consideration of the response of the non-native community to blockades. My impressions are based on a collation and analysis of all BC blockades reported in the media since 1980, and are supplemented by readings and interviews. Some caveats are in order. First, the survey is introductory. The subject demands further, more thorough investigations. Blockades and the forces that beget them are complex and as varied as are the First Nations that occupy the land now called British Columbia. My reading tends towards a broad overview rather than towards a detailed investigation of the issues I raise. However, the importance of the blockade and the paucity of other academic analyses suggest the need to offer an initial survey. Second, I have not attempted an extended historical analysis. The evidence suggests, however, that the blockade has long been a part of the tactical armory of the First Nations. Certainly, the grievances that underlie its use are deeply rooted in the native colonial experience. Finally, I cannot speak of First Nations grievances or strategies with the authority of a native commentator. To the extent that I seem to attempt to do so, I venture into dangerous waters. However, the blockade, in both its effects and its meanings, is directed outwards. It is aimed at the dominant culture, my culture. As such, it would seem to demand my attention. To the extent that the blockade speaks graphically of generations of friction, grievances, and lost opportunities, it deserves attention and analysis from whatever quarter. And to the extent that the blockade is often surrounded with misinformation and racist hysteria, the need for that attention has never been more urgent. At a broader level, I will not attempt a theoretical analysis of the blockade. Ideally, I wish the blockade to speak for itself. In these post-structuralist times, such a claim is difficult to sustain, so I should lay my scholarly cards on the table. I view the blockade through the prism of my discipline, geography. Recent scholarship in geography and cognate fields has centered on the exploration of power and space. Much of this is centered on the importance of space in the regulation and organization of dominated populations. A smaller literature is considered the geography of counter-hegemonic struggles, struggles that center on mobility have received less attention. In my own work, I have argued that mobility plays an important role in political relations, operating at both a functional and representational level. Suffice it to say that the study of blockades provides rich ground for those interested in theoretical questions. As I shall note, Blockades are intentionally spatial tactics at both an instrumental and a symbolic level. I shall suggest that their efficacy, in part, also rests on the scattered geography of colonization. At the same time, the regulation and representation of mobility is significant. I suggest that the restrictions upon personal movement occasioned by blockades must be counterposed to the forced mobility visited upon native communities through economic and cultural dislocation. However, other representations of mobility, such as the putative individual right to unfettered movement, has been used to delegitimize such collective mobility claims. At whatever level, contending practices and representations of space seem critical to an informed understanding of the politics of blockades. If it is hard to avoid questions of social theory in the context of postcolonial politics in British Columbia, it is even harder to avoid ethics. It will be clear from the discussion below that I am not attempting a bloodless analysis of blockades. Like anyone involved in the discussion, I hold a number of views and beliefs. Some of these no doubt are submerged and only indirectly visible to me. Some may be contradictory. However, it seems self-evident that my present well-being as a British Columbian, as a professor, as a landowner, as a recipient of social benefits of various sorts, is significantly sustained by wealth forcefully expropriated from Native peoples through generations of oppression and marginalization. No amount of legal legerdemain or rhetorical sophistry can convince me that the process by which the original inhabitants of what is now British Columbia were dispossessed, economically, politically, and culturally, was anything but unjust and immoral. I also have grave concerns about the symbolic portrayal of First Nations and their affairs by the dominant culture. Racist characterizations of Native peoples abound, whether they appear as noble savages, as peoples without history, or as irrational and amoral. In part, this article is an intervention that seeks to counter some of these representations. Clearly, it is not sufficient. It merely represents my tentative and no doubt partial attempt to make some sense of one aspect of the postcolonial encounter. While the Native blockade jumped to prominence with the Oka Standoff in 1990, Native peoples across Canada have long used blockades and protests centering on land claims, fishery access, military maneuvers on disputed land, and so on. Most Native blockades over the last 15 years have been in British Columbia. In part, this is due to the high proportion of Native people in the province. More significant, however, is the long history of BC's Native activism, centered on the historical refusal of the province to countenance Aboriginal title. With few exceptions, BC bands have never signed treaties extinguishing their rights to lands and self-government. Until 1991, the provincial government refused to recognize Aboriginal title. Over the last century, Native peoples have advanced long-standing concerns over such issues as the loss of Native lands and sovereignty, as well as over more immediate issues, such as the designation of reserve lands. Their method of doing so has ranged from the formal, e.g., the delegation of chiefs to Victoria in the 1880s, to the more direct, e.g., blockades. From the patchy evidence available, blockades have long been in use in BC. While there was an artificial calm for much of the first half of the 20th century, enforced in part by legal restrictions on land claims and organizing, the mid-1970s saw the first extended use of blockades as a political tool in BC. The upsurge of activism that occasioned blockades, as well as other modes of protest, was due partly to growing Native radicalism in the United States, and partly to a deepening dissatisfaction with the province's continued dismissal of Aboriginal title. The latter was all the more objectionable, given the election of a new Democratic Party government that many First Nations felt had promised otherwise while in opposition. The summers of 1974 and 1975 saw a number of instances of direct action that included the use of blockades. In May and June 1975, for example, at least 13 blockades were established, their targets including public highways, logging roads, public works yards, the Office of the Department of Indian Affairs, DIA, and a rail line. By the mid-1980s, the majority of BC First Nations had submitted their formal statements of land claim to the federal government. Political frustrations grew with the glacial pace of federal negotiations. At the same time, the provincial government continued to insist that Aboriginal title did not exist. This proved too much for many First Nations, especially in light of the continued resource extraction that is occurring on traditional territories. The consequence was a number of blockades, the most significant of which were at Lyell Island on Haida Gwaii, Queen Charlotte Islands, involving the Haida, and at Mears Island in Clayquot Sound, involving the Clayquot and Ahusat. The campaigns in both areas were sophisticated and protracted, involving injunctions by resource companies and counter-injunctions by First Nations. In both cases, blockaders permanently halted resource extraction. Their success must have proved an influential model to other First Nations. The summer of 1990 saw the most extensive round of blockades ever. Nearly 30 blockades occurred, involving some 20 different groups. Unlike the blockades of the 1980s, which had often been placed on remote logging roads, many were now placed on public routes, including major roads and rail lines. At their peak, Vancouver newspapers even began publishing traffic advisories for travelers, detailing interior blockades. Some of these blockades, particularly the Lilwat People Movement's Duffy Lake blockade from July to November, were protracted and controversial, sparking protests and counter-blockades by non-natives. Although many of the blockades were sparked by the Oka standoff in Quebec, the reasoning and form of each must be related to local factors. Increasingly, Native anger was directed at BC's social credit government, which continued to deny Aboriginal title and to engage in scaremongering about its likely consequences. Typical was the dismissive claim of Forest Minister Claude Richmond, who complained that a few militant Indians have chosen to draw the map the size of many European countries and proclaim it as theirs. In July, however, the province grudgingly recognized, quote, certain Aboriginal rights and interests, end quote, though Premier Van der Zaam refused to acknowledge Aboriginal title, which he felt would be to recognize Aboriginal ownership, lock, stock, and barrel. With the election of an NDP government in 1991, the provincial government finally acknowledged the existence of Aboriginal title. Both federal and provincial governments have since played an active role in land claims negotiations. A majority of First Nations have chosen to participate in the new treaty process established by the province. As a consequence, blockade activity has decreased from the high point of 1990, as many First Nations either have opted not to blockade or have been required not to engage in such activities in order to ensure the continuation of negotiations. If the frequency of blockades has declined, the furor surrounding them has not. The year 1995 saw a number of particularly controversial blockades, notably at the Douglas Lake Ranch, Adams Lake, and near Parksville, all of which were initiated by bands that had chosen to stay out of the treaty process. The treaty process has been rejected by a number of bands as a sellout of Native sovereignty and, in the words of one Native activist, Stuart Phillip, Penticton band counselor, as, quote, a stalling process to allow corporations to rape and pillage our resources, end quote. Criticism has also been leveled at the top-down nature of the negotiations, which involves some of the First Nations leadership, but not the grassroots. Many of the older political fault lines, such as those between Coast and Interior First Nations, have reemerged. Facing re-election, the NDP administration came under considerable fire for its supposed weak handling of these issues. Criticism of the treaty process, combined with continued resource extraction, meant that the blockade is unlikely to disappear in the near future. I define a blockade as an attempt to interfere with the flow of people and or commodities through the placement of an obstruction, either partial or complete. My definition is somewhat loose, given the temporal and geographic variation in blockades. There is an important difference between the information checkpoint, where traffic is slowed and information, e.g. pamphlets, given out, and the full blockade, where all non-native movement is denied. A partial blockade can also occur when select traffic, notably logging trucks, is denied access. In a few cases, tolls are collected. The duration of the blockade can vary from a symbolic hour or two to many days. The 1990 Duffy Lake blockade at 118 days being the longest. There seems to be considerable variation in the degree of organization associated with blockades. In some cases, they seem to be carefully premeditated, part of a long campaign involving legal and extra-legal tactics. They can involve sophisticated media presentations and prearranged understandings between police and local bands. The Penticton Band's 1994 blockade of the Apex Ski Resort is a case in point. In other cases, blockades can be set unofficially by individual members of the group over some specific grievance. Figure 1, drawn from a media survey, reveals the diversity and geographic distribution of blockades across the province. Generally, blockades are established on reserve land. Given the very large number of bands that have participated in such actions, they have occurred across the province, with a few clear concentrations. For example, Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en territories have long been a center of activism and direct action. The site of the blockade can vary. Of the 55 blockades that I've recorded between 1980 and 1995, for which a location was identified, 28, 51%, occurred on public roads, 16, 42%, on private logging roads and other works roads, and 9, 16% on rail lines. At the risk of oversimplification, the blockade appears to be deployed in two ways. Either the mobility of others is curtailed, essentially to protest some unrelated grievances, or the movement into or from a traditional territory is itself at issue. In the first case, a First Nation's ability to place restrictions on movement is used in an attempt to attract media and government attention, and thence to negotiate redress. In the second, that very movement is the cause of contention. By my estimates, two-thirds of the blockades fall into the latter category, while the summer of 1990 saw many examples of the former, as information blockades were established across the province in support of OCA and to advance local land claims. An example would be the information picket established on Lionsgate Bridge on the 30th of July 1990 by members of the Squamish Nation, who handed out invitations to a longhouse discussion on OCA and BC lands claims to rush hour motorists. As the Lionsgate Bridge is the most direct connection between downtown Vancouver and the North Shore suburbs, commuters were powerfully reminded of the often forgotten fact that the bridge crosses the Squamish Reserve. The blockade is also used to regulate movement where movement itself is in dispute. More often than not, the massive and unsustainable outmovement of capital and commodities from traditional territories is the focus of the blockade. The ease and the speed with which the resources of traditional First Nations territories are stripped from traditional lands by corporations are matters of grave concern. The blockade is frequently seen as a means of physically halting that flow. In 1989, Gitxsan Wet'suwet'en spokesperson Don Ryan described being forced into, quote, freezing the land, everything, logging, mining, forestry, lands, water, end quote. There are many examples of such actions, including the 1985 Haida blockade on Lyell Island, which was set to prevent logging trucks from entering an area of great cultural significance, and two blockades in 1993 and 1994, which were established by the Penticton Band to prevent construction crews from working on the expansion of a ski resort that local bands considered to be both environmentally unsustainable and an encroachment on claimed lands. Frequently, both protest and access concerns are behind a blockade. For example, several Tsilkotin bands shut down the only road through the Tsilkotin region for 2 hours in July 1990. In part, the blockade was to protest military maneuvers north of the Tusi Reserve. In part, it sought to slow the pace of logging west of Williams Lake. More generally, the aim was to attract attention to underlying grievances concerning land claims negotiations. As Tusi Band Chief Francis Lakis noted, the government better seriously start negotiations with the Tsilkotin people over the land title question, or next time the roadblocks won't be just for a few hours. The state's reaction to such action varies, depending in part on location. If a blockade occurs in a gazetted highway covered by the Highways Act, the RCMP may seek to remove the barrier. On a non-gazetted road, such as the logging road, the police may play a mediating role, seeking to maintain the peace and to bring a negotiated end to the blockade. While the RCMP have generally relied on negotiations to end a blockade, there have been instances in which confrontation has occurred, usually over the attempt to enforce an injunction. The NDP government consistently claims not to negotiate while blockade is in place, preferring the formal lands claim process as an arena for discussion. As there are 175 First Nations with which to deal, there is a perceived need for a comprehensive approach to land claims. Blockades could allow one group to jump the queue, it is argued. Observers often suggest that blockades are established over minor and frivolous grievances. Implicit here is the assumption that blockades are not principled acts of civil disobedience, but actions caused by a few malcontents seeking to foment discord. In other words, as one commentator suggested, Rudy Platiel, author of the Globe and Mail article cited below, quote, it's payback time, a seductive opportunity for young natives to rebel, particularly against white authority, in the name of upholding their people's rights, end quote. In some cases, blockades can be indeed set unofficially by individual members of a group. An unofficial blockade can either prompt other band members to rally behind it, and ultimately lead to the involvement of the band leadership, or, more rarely, it can lead to a diplomatic distancing of, or even an official disavowal by that leadership. However, while renegade blockades do occur, they seem to be the exception. Generally, it seems, blockades are established after wide deliberations within a band, and on occasion, with neighboring bands or a full council. Moreover, even if the dispute that prompts the blockade seems minor to outsiders, it seems reasonable that, given the legal risk and organizational demands, a blockade can only be sustained by deep-seated grievances. Not surprisingly, the decision to blockade does not seem to be taken lightly, but is often a last-ditch attempt to regain recognition for a grievance when less confrontational methods have failed. Many feel that the provincial government's denial of Aboriginal title prior to 1991, along with suspicion concerning subsequent treaty negotiations, have provided First Nation peoples with no other outlet. To the extent that it signals a deliberate defiance of the established codes of political conduct, the petition, quiet diplomacy, etc., combined with a deliberate attempt to draw public and state attention to a specific set of concerns, the blockade can best be thought of as a form of strategic militancy rather than as a random and unplanned act. However, if the blockade is thought of simply as a tactical decision in a rational political struggle, then we miss some of its significance and its importance to those involved. For the decision to blockade is further sustained and justified with reference to a complex set of cultural understandings inherent to Native peoples. If a blockade serves to deny logging trucks access to a disputed area, in other words, that action may be justified not only in terms of the protection of a disputed economic resource, narrowly defined, but also in terms of the innate rights of a people to manage its own affairs and a non-negotiable mandate from the Creator to protect lands that it holds in its trust. To that extent, the blockade is frequently sustained by much more than an immediate set of instrumental concerns. With that in mind, the reported reasons for blockades, on the basis of a partial survey conducted between 1980 and 1995, suggests a wide range of concerns, with land claims and the protection of timber resources topping the list. The two are closely related. Given the lack of treaties, land use disputes have frequently escalated into struggles over land ownership. As indicated above, the blockade is frequently chosen as a political tactic by many, though not all, First Nations. This raises an obvious and important question. Why the blockade as opposed to other tactical options, such as the occupation of official buildings or private lands, public protests, etc.? Blockades have been used many times by other oppositional groups. The case of the Clayquot environmental blockade of 1993 and the use of the Union picket line are cases in point. However, the frequency and intensity of native blockades in BC suggests that it is seen as a particularly effective form of direct action. Indeed, the blockade need not be established to be effective. Its threatened use may be enough. The reason for choosing the blockade is complex, but it must surely rest on the fact that blockades work. That is, they often advance native goals. This is particularly significant given the politically disadvantaged position of First Nations in British Columbia. Interestingly, blockades seem not only to overcome many of these obstacles, but to turn them to advantage. This occurs at both a material and a symbolic level. Let me treat each of these issues in turn. Most of British Columbia's scanty population live in a few urban centers, most notably, of course, in the extreme southwest of the province. This population is dependent on an attenuated transport system made up of a few major roads and rail routes. The low-density population and the rugged terrain mean surprisingly few transport connections. At the same time, the provincial economy is still largely dependent on gaining access to increasingly isolated pockets of resources, such as timber. Vast amounts of usually unprocessed raw materials are then hauled out for delivery to distant export markets. The result is that the closure of one or two transport routes can have profound consequences. While many blockades have been on relatively minor routes, such as logging roads, a well-placed blockade on a major transport route can have profound consequences. Of special significance were the closures of the Duffy Lake Road in the summer of 1990, which cut off the towns of Pemberton from the east and Lillooet from the west, and the Stolo blockade on the main CN rail line into Vancouver in 1993, which cost CN around $3 million a day. The Gixxen have also become very adept at the rail blockade, blocking the main CN rail line on several occasions to disrupt the movement of minerals and forest products. In this context, the reported threat by Native leaders to shut the province down is not far-fetched as one might suppose. The vulnerability of the transport system is further aggravated by the fact that the road and rail lines frequently pass through reserves, which are, as noted, the usual location for blockades. Not only are such transport corridors an obvious focus for First Nations, given their proximity and their strategic importance to the provincial infrastructure, but they are themselves a frequent source of irritation, given the presumptuous manner in which they were established. For example, temporary access routes such as logging roads can become so used by non-natives that, over time, the assumption becomes that they are public rights of way, although access may, in law, be entirely at the discretion of a band council. Denied access by blockade, aggrieved non-natives may condemn native actions as a violation of their right to travel, when in fact they may themselves be in trespass. This was at issue, for example, in the dispute at Adams Lake in early 1995. Even the designation and use of supposedly public rights of way through reserves is often disputed by bands and can become a catalyst for blockade action. A Carrier Sicani chief recently commented that there were up to 500 such disputed rights of way across the province, any of which could flare up into a blockade. Provincial officials put the number of disputed rights of way at 225, noting that 900 public roads cut through reserves. One means by which the province claims the right to expropriate rights of way on reserve land is under Order in Council 1036, which provides for the resumption of reserve lands for the purpose of making roads, providing that the land so resumed shall not exceed 1/20th of the whole reserve. The constitutionality of this provision is, however, unclear. Far from constituting an illegitimate denial of the mobility rights of others, a number of decisions suggest that many blockades may be justified denials of illegal trespass. A turning point, judicially speaking, was the extended dissent of J.A. Southern in BCAG versus Mount Currie Indian Band. In this view, the blockade is far from an act of civil disobedience, as are the actions of a householder who is defending her property against trespass. In other words, if anyone is engaged in civil disobedience, it is the non-band members and the provincial government. The vulnerability of the transport system is further aggravated by the provincial topography. The rugged terrain ensures that valley bottoms become transport corridors. Reserves are often located in valleys near rivers. The official position is that, in many cases, either there was no way around the reserve or a road was built to connect reserves with other settlements. A more cynical reading might suggest that the expropriation of reserved land, as opposed to privately held land, offered the path of least resistance to a province long mesmerized by road and rail as an instrument of development. Rail lines are often the target of native blockades. Again, they are an easy target because they frequently bisect reserves. BC rail lines, for example, run through or beside 20 reserves in British Columbia. The existence of such routes and the process by which they were established often remains a point of disagreement for generations, thus resulting in rail lines often being seen as logical sites of protest. One striking case, for example, was the 1985 one-man blockade established by a Gixxen chief who stood in front of trains from Prince Rupert to demand compensation for 100 acres of land that the Gitwungak Reserve lost to the Grand Trunk Railroad in 1910. Stolo leaders chose to block a certain section of the main CN line running through the Cheam Reserve in a 1993 protest over salmon quotas, as the site was part of a century-old property dispute between the band and the railway. The association between blockades and the provincial transport system is double-edged. Transport systems imposed upon reserve land become an obvious focus for protest, particularly as resources extracted from traditional territories pour down the roads, logging routes, and rail lines. Yet the ability to regulate movement along those very transport corridors can become a powerful political tool, Cole Harris has described the historical development of the province's system of transportation and communication as, quote, the capillaries of colonial appropriation. They allowed non-natives into the land, not as explorers, visitors, or passers-through, but as users and settlers, end quote. Not only did this facilitate the direct dispossession of native peoples and the development of an economy dependent on the plunder of native resources, but the changing conceptions of space and time that underpin these new transportation systems also, he suggests, colonized native consciousness. While this was undoubtedly the case, it can also be argued that the impact of the transport system was, as I have said, double-edged. Paul Tennant has shown that the emergent transport system helped to facilitate grassroots organizing within and between various First Nations. The geography of the blockade also suggests that the transport system has served as a critical and successful site for resistance. The ability to reconfigure such modern systems of domination gives the lie to those who find native political tactics locked in a pre-modern past. In the case of blockade activity, a system of colonization has itself become the focus and the weapon in a counter-colonial struggle. Transport lines are vulnerable due to the export orientation and resource base of the provincial economy, the dispersed nature of the transport system, and the location of transport corridors relative to reserves. The fact that the reserve is the usual focus for the blockade is important when one remembers its scattered distribution. Like many of the native peoples in the U.S., native peoples in British Columbia were dispersed into large numbers of small, isolated reserves. The province has over 1,600 reserves, with an average size of less than 1 square mile. Ironically, while such dispersion could be seen as an obstacle to united action, it makes the blockade particularly telling. Blockades being scattered are very disruptive and hard to regulate. When several are in place simultaneously, as in the summer of 1990, the effect can be striking. As one is resolved, another emerges, much as do the forest fires that flare up across the interior as the summer storms sweep across the mountains. Similarly, with a few exceptions, blockades have been non-coordinated. Although there have been some calls for collective action, most blockades appear to be established either by individual bands or by the larger tribal groupings to which a band belongs. Individual councils, bands, or band members take the decision to blockade. The lack of a clear political center makes the blockade potentially unpredictable and thus powerful as a tactical tool. As with the case of the transport system, adversity can be turned to advantage. Finally, blockades are not necessarily tied to an individual location, but on occasion can be reallocated, more or less at will, along a given transport corridor. This is especially the case given that, in most cases, a blockade is little more than a symbolic line marked, perhaps by a flag or spiked board. This flexibility can be of great consequence and distinguishes First Nations blockades from those that are necessarily tied to a specific site, such as the Union Picket. A striking, if somewhat unusual, example of this occurred between the 24th of July and the 26th of August 1990, when the Seton Lake, Fountain, Pavilion, and Mount Currie bands blockaded the BC Rail main line to show solidarity with the Mohawk at Oka and to air their grievances over unresolved land claims. The first rail blockade at Seton Portage was dismantled when it was reported that an RCMP riot squad was en route to the site, but it was then re-established at a Mount Currie location. The track was again blocked at Seton Portage, and an RCMP raid led to several arrests. This prompted the re-establishment of the blockade at Mount Currie, which in turn was dismantled when it was learned the police were en route. The Seton blockade was set up a third time. This time, the only road access route to Seton Portage was also blockaded in order to prevent the RCMP from serving an injunction. The blockade does not operate only in the material world of physical movement. It must also be considered in terms of the meanings it endows and with which it is freighted. As a blockade reflects deeply rooted disputes, it is not surprising that the blockade itself will be cast in different ways by opposing groups. And to the extent that a blockade relates to questions of mobility, rights, and space, it is to be expected that these will be contested in turn. For those behind it, The blockade has a symbolic effect to the extent that it marks out two spaces. In an immediate sense, it maps out a boundary, and in doing so distinguishes a Indian space from a Euro-Canadian space. Presumably, there are two audiences to which the claim of such a demarcation is directed. To the dominant society, the claim is an assertion of place, implying a native rejection of generations of systemic racism, territorial dispossession, and economic marginalization. To the First Nations, the claim is one of shared aspirations and identity, as well as principled defiance. To be able to assert some claim to and control over space, albeit temporary, through a blockade both relies upon and further sustains First Nations claims to unabrogated sovereignty over specific territory. As Terry John, one of the Duffy Lake blockaders, put it, "The road that we're blocking is in our own territory, and we are protecting our sovereignty and our land. We're asserting our own rights so the police don't have any jurisdiction in our territory, so they can't tell us to take our roadblock down." Such an assertion, symbolic and material, is a claim about place. As a statement concerning sovereignty and place, a blockade must be of profound importance for people who have long been denied them. Systematically dispossessed by settlers, crowded onto marginalized reserves, confronted with legalized and informal forms of oppression and racism, a First Nation's claim to place through a blockade marks not only assertion of ownership in the narrow sense, but a spiritually laden association of being. As long ago as 1910, Native leaders described how they had lost any real home in this, our own country, noting that, gradually, we have become regarded as trespassers over a large portion of this, our country. Hereditary chiefs and elders of the Nooksalk Nation engaged in a blockade at Fog Creek near Bella Coola in September 1995, justified their actions as a reoccupation of traditional lands. "Be on watch for the land that our people of the past lived at," urged an elder who participated in the blockade. "These places were named by the Creator. Our people have never forgotten these names, and this proves this land still belongs to Nooksalk Mi." Moreover, the temporary ability to control the movement of others must also be particularly significant. Mobility has all too often been something visited upon First Nations, for example, through the residential school program, or the displacement of entire communities, such as the Cheslada, whose village was destroyed by an Alcan hydroelectric scheme, or the Moachat people of Friendly Cove, who were forced to move to a substandard site once funding for their own school was discontinued. More subtle, but no less destructive, is the native diaspora caused by endemic unemployment on reserves. The economic displacements of reserve life sit uneasily alongside the fabulous natural wealth of traditional lands, systematically strip-mined by transnational forest and mining corporations. One can see why the disruption of the outward flow of those dollars and jobs must seem an appealing, even necessary option. Lavina White, Haida elder, describes the tension. "The barges are going out, about 3 loads of timber a day is going out past our reserve, and yet we have to live. There's no jobs for anybody, 93% unemployed, or 97% in some instances." Further, controls over and representations of native mobility have been frequently used against First Nations, with pernicious results. One particularly insidious characterization by the dominant society has been that of the wandering Indian. Deemed nomadic and shiftless, First Nations people had no real claim to place and title due to the quote-unquote unstructured nature of their society. The success of market names such as Winnebago, Cadillac, and Pontiac all attest to this association between wild, free movement and the quote-unquote imaginary Indian. However, if mobility was traditionally part of native societies, it was not unstructured but closely attuned to the cycles of the environment and the traditional resource economy. This sustainable mobility is a long way from the extractions of resource-based capitalism. Such a reading of blockades is far from that of many non-native observers, whether local loggers or provincial officials. The territories and the resources that the blockades seek to preserve are not freighted with the same cultural and political meanings for non-natives as they are for natives. This is not to say, I hasten to add, that there are no examples of consensus between native and non-native. Underreported, perhaps because they detract from the media tendency to seek confrontation and to ignore concord, there have nevertheless been cases in which non-native communities have either supported blockades or even, quote-unquote, put their bodies on the line. The shared concerns have been environmental and economic. However, there are also many cases in which blockades have been opposed by local non-native people who have seen the resources behind a blockade as a source of job and income vital to the survival of marginalized single-industry towns. The blockade, in this sense, speaks of radically different conceptions of space. The Mount Currie blockade pitted the Lillooet People's Movement, which sought to protect ancestral gravesites, against local loggers, who felt their jobs and way of life were being threatened. The different geographies invoked by opposing interests were as much a cause as an effect of this blockade. Quote, one side says the latest round of skirmishes in BC's land claims war is taking place within the Ur Creek drainage basin, Pemberton Sioux Timber Supply Area, Vancouver Forest Region. The other side says the battle is taking place at Ahua, near the shore of the lake of the two-headed serpent that can take human form, at the place where ancestral ghosts welcome the spirits of the dead into the afterlife. End quote. At the more removed levels of the state and the media, representations of blockades cover a wide range. For a minority of observers, a blockade is often the principled act of a desperate people. This claim can often become romanticized, as native peoples are essentialized as noble guardians of the primeval forest. More common is the negative portrayal of a blockade, considered primarily in terms of its effects on the movement of non-natives. Given the liberal tradition of the Canadian polity, it is usually framed in terms of an individual's right to move, unchecked by illegitimate constraint. As such, a blockade is often regarded as problematic, if not illegitimate. For example, the then Minister of the Environment suggested in July 1990, at the peak of blockade activity, that while demonstrations should be permitted for short periods, that being a privilege of democracy that we enjoy, it should, quote, also be possible for any British Columbian or any Canadian or any tourist from anywhere else to get on any public road and drive anywhere they want in the province of British Columbia, hindered by nothing except the regulations of the road, stopped by no one and diverted by no one. In my view, they've got an absolute right to drive on the highway unobstructed. I don't see that there can be much doubt about that. End quote. While there is no doubt that blockades do, quite deliberately, interfere with the free movement of individuals, there are selective silences in this account. While there is a common law right to travel on a public highway, the legal status of many putatively public routes through reserved lands may mean, as noted, that quote-unquote free movement is legally trespass. Furthermore, although liberal notions of mobility rights are necessarily hostile to the blockade, as it contradicts the individual citizen's right to move, a case can be made for considering mobility rights as collective and therefore as resting not only on the right to move, but also on the right to stay and to resist forced mobility. To that extent, the action of a First Nation in seeking to control its economic destiny, through blockades, for example, could constitute a form of positive mobility right, that of staying in place and resisting the mobility forced upon it by cultural and economic dislocation. However, the effect of construing mobility rights narrowly is to render this alternative reading invisible and to cast the blockader as engaged, at best, in illegitimate action. As seems often the case in such instances, the blockade is demonized and dismissed. On occasion, as noted above, a blockade is regarded merely as a demonstration. Thus degraded, it clearly cannot be allowed to trump the individual's right to free movement. Yet, to the extent that it does interfere with the mobility of citizens and workers, the blockade is condemned as a criminal conspiracy or a form of random terrorism. Groups that oppose or are highly skeptical of the treaty process in general tend to seize upon blockade activity as an expression of illegitimate dissent. Such groups include the BC Fisheries Survival Coalition, the BC Reform Party, and BC Fire, many members of whom use the language of individual rights to oppose the granting of what is deemed special status or racialized group rights to Native peoples. Playing on fears of resource depletion and economic insecurity, Such groups have often been able to direct the debate in partial and unbalanced ways. The lack of a discursive counterweight to such claims, other than from within the First Nations community itself, is cause for concern. The blockade has become an established component of the First Nations tactical armory in British Columbia, and the last 15 years have seen many examples of its use. This article interprets the blockade as a political phenomenon. Generalization is difficult, however, given that blockades have arisen in quite different circumstances. A significant difference, for example, exists between those before and those after 1990. Further, they can take a variety of forms. While the duration, form, and location of blockades varies, they can usually be differentiated according to their quote-unquote protest or quote-unquote access functions. I've tried to consider why blockades are so frequent in British Columbia as compared to other forms of political action, and suggest that their instrumental and symbolic effects may make them appealing to a people who feel they lack alternatives. In instrumental terms, the distribution of the transport system, topography, and regional resource economy, and the allocation of reserves play an important role. In symbolic terms, a blockade marks out a claim to place, and in so doing, challenges the dominant readings of place and the forms of mobility, both material and representational, visited upon Native peoples. In both contexts, the blockade often serves to turn adversity to advantage. While blockades have proved successful, their continued use should not be celebrated. They speak to a systematic and enduring failure on the part of the dominant society to accommodate the legitimate demands of colonized peoples. In that sense, the more important and thus more troubling blockades of British Columbia are not established by First Nations. They are those of the dominant society established over a century ago and systematically maintained by the forces of economic marginalization, political paternalism, and cultural racism. The problem, in other words, is not the First Nations blockade, but the oppression that calls it forth. If we are troubled by blockades, it is that oppression that must be confronted and challenged.